Question 6 on the exam was about lead iodide. It states here that lead iodide is an ionic compound that is insoluble in water. At the same time I do this, let's talk about KSP values again. I was thinking of the next question. We had some difficulty in generating the right expression for a KSP. Lead iodide will dissociate, if it dissociates, I'm sorry, would make lead plus two ions and two iodide ions. The reason I wanted to write this dissociation out is you can see that although there's a 2 as a subscript in the reactant, the 2 becomes a stoichiometric factor in the product because the ions all separate out from each other. Again, anticipating the next question that was about calcium or cobalt phosphate, when that dissociates, the 3 cobalt ions separate from each other, as well as the 2 phosphate ions. There aren't so many cases where the ions fail to separate, although there is one that you may or may not have learned about back in Chem 1A. The mercury plus 1 ion is something that will react with itself in solution. So in fact, we don't write mercury plus as a discrete species. We always write it this way. This is something that is known as a dimer. Which the way I'm going to express that here is that it is 2 formula units that are bound together. You might not be familiar with the term dimer or trimer or oligomer, but you might know its big cousin, the polymer. All a polymer is a string of atoms or molecules, generally of the similar type, that are all linked one to another. So mercury in solution will spontaneously form this dimer, which means the 2 of them join together. So even if we're writing a dissociation reaction for a compound involving mercury like this, the HG2 would stay together as one unit. But if we have a compound like lead iodide or cobalt phosphate, all of those ions separate from each other. The reason that matters is that it's those stoichiometric factors that we get in the products that we use to make the KSP expression. So if you don't correctly dissociate the compound, you're not going to get the right KSP. And KSP is related even to the lead iodide problem, even though we're not doing any calculations with it. Because if lead iodide is insoluble, then what that means is its KSP is much, much less than 1. Because KSP is products over reactants, and so that's another aspect of writing out these dissociation reactions. By convention, we always show the solid dissociating to form the ions. So a KSP expression is always ions over nothing. Because even though it's products over reactants, the reactant's a solid in this case, which means it's not part of the solution, which means it doesn't have a calculable concentration. So if lead iodide is insoluble, that means you hardly produce any ions, which means that the K value is much, much less than 1. There were 2 equations related to free energy that we had reviewed in lecture that you were told that you needed to know for the exam. One of them was that delta G is equal to RT natural log of K, the equilibrium constant, and that delta G is a composite of 2 other thermodynamic functions, enthalpy and entropy. The first sub-question of this problem says, state whether dissolving lead iodide in water results in a positive or negative change in free energy. Explain your choice, being sure to write any equation that you use to justify your answer. So if we have a K much less than 1, then that automatically means the free energy is greater than zero. And that is all that you have to say for that problem. What some of you tried to do was discuss enthalpy and entropy. Because reading the next part of the problem, it says, assuming that forming a lead iodide solution is a favorable process in terms of entropy. That's a super critical qualification statement there. That dissolving is favorable in terms of entropy. Because entropy has nothing to do with enthalpy. So there were quite a number of people, not just this section, but the other one as well, that said because it's favorable entropy, then it compensates for the enthalpy. That's what you were programmed to say earlier in the quarter when we were talking about solubility, maybe. But it doesn't turn out to be true in this case. Because it doesn't dissolve, that is what means K is low. Because K is low, that means delta G is positive. From there, then we can talk about what's going to happen with enthalpy, but that's the next part of the question. So I guess let me complete that rest part of it here. Assuming that forming a lead iodide solution is a favorable process in terms of entropy, state whether an increase or decrease in temperature would occur if lead iodide dissolved. So it's an if lead iodide dissolved. What the most common answer was appropriate for this question. What could you do to temperature in order to make lead iodide soluble? Because many of you looked at that second equation, saw that temperature was a variable in that equation and thought, oh, it's a question about temperature. And so if you looked at that and said, okay, well, because delta S is positive, if we make T big enough, that's going to make that expression negative. But that's not what the question asked. The question didn't ask what would we do to temperature to make this a favorable process. It was the reverse question. It said, if this happened, then what would delta H be? Because delta G, from the previous question, is greater than zero. When it tells you that entropy is favorable, that means delta S is greater than zero. If delta S is greater than zero and delta G is also greater than zero, the only way mathematically that's going to happen is if delta H is greater than zero. And that's an endothermic process. Endothermic, meaning that the solid is absorbing energy in order to dissociate. So from the solid's perspective, energy is going up. But the energy has to come from somewhere. It comes from the solution. So if you have an endothermic process, that means that the temperature drops. So let me back up and kind of review this again, because I know there's a lot of pieces of this that are linked together. We start out with the idea this is insoluble, which some of you intuitively said that meant that it's not a favorable process. And in fact, many of you got the last part of the question we're going to come to correct, even if you didn't get the first parts of the question correct. But because it doesn't dissolve, that means it's bad in terms of free energy, which means it's delta G greater than zero. The second part of the question is where the most difficulty probably came, which is what is going to happen with temperature. And again, because temperature shows up as a variable in this expression, some of you were tricked, I think, into trying to solve for T. But the question was really asking about delta H. Because if all you're doing is dissolving and you're not adding the heat actively or removing it actively, then you're talking about what's going to happen with delta H. And because delta G is greater than zero, and because it's a favorable entropic process, delta S is greater than zero, that automatically means that delta H is greater than zero, which means the temperature goes down. Now, the last part of the question, I was very, very liberal in how I graded. Pretty much, if you said anything that made sense and it was self-consistent, then you got credit for that problem. Because what it said was, based on your answer to the previous question, Now, I ignored that because many of you did not get the previous question right. So that I did not take off points twice, I ignored that part. So state whether the magnitude of lattice energy for lead iodide is larger or smaller than the magnitude of its heat of hydration, and explain your choice. Again, most of you didn't get around to explaining. You just stated the answer. So the real answer is, if the temperature goes down because delta H is greater than zero, then that's because the lattice energy is greater than hydration. Why? Because lattice energy is always a positive value. Hydration is always a negative value. And so if we have an increase in the energy of the mixture, then the only way to get that is if lattice energy is greater. Realize this is not the picture that's true for all solids. If we did have a solid that dissolved to release energy, then the diagram would be this instead. And if in part B of the question you had said that the temperature goes up, then really that's the graph you should have drawn to match the idea that the temperature goes up. But again, if as long as you were consistent in what you said in part C, then I ignored its connection to part B. The real answer, again, is the one on the left, that because the temperature is going down, because that process is endothermic, then lattice energy, the cost to break the ions apart, is bigger than hydration, the benefit you get from the ions surrounding water, by water afterwards. Are there any questions of any kind on that problem? Now, because I, in the process of talking about this problem, brought up the cobalt phosphate, let me point out that that is the correct dissociation equation for cobalt phosphate. And the KSP expression for this then would be cobalt cubed phosphate squared. The part of the question where it asks, how do you know the precipitate forms? Forming a precipitate does not depend on K. K just establishes how much of the solid can dissociate in solution. Whether a precipitate forms depends on how many ions really are present at that time, which is Q. So in other words, if QSP is greater than KSP, then a precipitate's going to form. So if there's no questions on this, let's switch over to talking just for a moment about lab reports. And I might have said this in lecture already, but just to repeat it here, for those of you who did email me lab reports, there will be a message that's going out basically saying that email is not a secure form of communication, and that I'm asking you to agree with that for you to receive your grade information. So I'll send you that first email, you reply back, then I send you back the email with the comments and the grades. If you do prefer to get your comments or grades in person, then you can do that instead. But since I have gotten through quite a number of the reports, I wanted to just tell you about some comments I had in general until you get your specific comments, but just wanted the class to hear this as a whole. Starting at the top, for your purpose statement, make sure that you're careful about the wording of your purpose statement so you really express what it really is that you're looking for in an experiment. To be kind of picky about it, I did see some reports that, for example, that said for the first experiment, the purpose was to determine the freezing point depression. But that's not quite true because you observe freezing point depression in each of the solutions that you measured. But what you really were trying to calculate then was the freezing point depression constant. So it's just one word difference, but it is inaccurate then. And We're trying to be very careful with what we say in our reports. On a similar line, I did see one purpose statement that said the purpose of the experiment was to determine the freezing point depression constant of the solution, which is not true either, because the freezing point depression constant is for the solvent. It doesn't matter what the solute you put in is. So the constant is only associated with that solvent. So minor wording issues, but still important to address. Moving on to data and calculations, I didn't really nitpick how your graphs looked like. I know many of you probably hadn't had to do graphs like that before, at least not that many in one report. So if you had anything that looked decent at all, I accepted it in terms of the temperature versus time graphs. For the linear extrapolation, you were supposed to do a linear extrapolation so that you could get the slope, which would be reported as your freezing point depression constant. Some of you averaged out and calculated it out instead, though. So you were supposed to do the graphical form, so even if you did get the correct answer doing it by averaging, you lost a small number of points just for failing to include that graph. There is one other error many of you made, but it only ended up costing you half a point, and that was the fact that on your graph, the one that you had temperature versus molality, it had to pass through the origin. Because if you don't have any solute, meaning you don't really have a solution, you just have a pure solvent, then the freezing point should be the freezing point for the solvent. There shouldn't be a deviation. So if you did do the linear extrapolation, you got an equation that said something along the lines of negative 1.96x minus 0.1, or minus 0.14. Well, the minus 0.14 means you didn't pass through the origin, because that minus 0.14 is a y-intercept. So you had to set the y-intercept to be equal to zero. In a discussion that came up in office hours, I've kind of reasoned out that you could not just include a zero data point, because the extrapolation would still just try to make the best line that could fit it through. So you have to force it to go through the origin by setting the intercept. But because that required you to have some skill with whatever program you were using, and because that's not directly related to chemistry, that's why if you didn't do it, it only cost you half a point. I had to take some token amount off to differentiate you from the people that did it completely correctly. Other small things I saw, some of you are a little bit sloppy with including units. So, yes, I know that you measured everything in grams, and I know it's grams, and I know you know it's grams, but you have to still say that your masses are in terms of grams. Now, I recommend that you do that at the top of the table in what's called the legend, the top of each column, because if you put it there, then it means everything listed under it is automatically got that same number of units. So, in other words, you only have to put the units in top instead of writing it after every single number that you measured. Similarly, because we're so used to operating in Celsius in this lab, some of you did not tell me that your delta T's were in Celsius. I even stopped commenting on it at some point because it got to be where I thought it was universal. Yes, Celsius is the default temperature, but don't fail to tell me it's the temperature, because some people operate in Kelvin, which in this case, if we just presume that nobody's talking about Fahrenheit, delta T is the same if it's Celsius or Kelvin, because the size of 1 degree Celsius is the same as the size of 1 Kelvin. So you kind of lucked out in that sense. But you still need to make sure to put your units in. Yes, I've been doing this too long, so I caught the people that wrote H20 instead of H2, the number or the letter O. I know it's a small thing, but do get your formulas right. It does look a little better for anyone that might be reading them. Something that's on the grand scale of things minor, but still confusing. Some of you aren't using all of the sig figs possible when not doing your calculations, but just writing down your masses. In fact, if you could hold on just 2 seconds, let me look at the balance room, and this will solve this mystery real quick for us. Thank you. No, it didn't solve the mystery because those all appear to be decimilligram balances, the balances that give you 4 digits after the decimal point. But some of you had mass numbers that only had 2 digits after the decimal point. So there's either a balance running around the room that I didn't know about, or you just failed to write down some of your data, which, why would you throw away data? Getting mass measurements out that far costs lots of money. So you're kind of, if you had to buy one of those balances, you would just be throwing money out the window. Or some of you are faking it. You're getting data from people from past labs and just reporting it, and we're using balances that those people didn't. So something funny was going on with some of the data measurements. Make sure that you don't throw away valid data, that you always report in your data all of the sig figs possible. Now, I do get a little lazy myself investigating sig figs in your calculations. The only comment, in fact, I would make about sig figs, other than failing to get the right masses, is if you gave me too many sig figs. I had a couple of people that gave me molality calculations with all the numbers that showed up on the calculator. But if you only have 4 digits, for example, in your mass measurement, you can't give me 20 in your molality. It doesn't make any sense. So I didn't even take points off if you use too many sig figs, but I did say something about it. What else did I see? Most people use tables were appropriate. More of you did more of the things right than I maybe had expected. I guess you got whipped around by your previous instructors well enough. There was one big oops, though, at least is the way that I format lab reports. When you do calculations, you do have to include both what's called the prototype and substituted equation. Prototype equations where you don't use numbers at all, you use words or symbols. So, for example, if you're calculating moles, a symbolic equation would be mass of substance divided by molar mass, in words or symbols, just like that. Then you do need to go back later and substitute in what your data were to come up with the final value. The reason I want you to do both of those things is because what if you use the wrong data to substitute in your equation? If all I saw was the numbers and I didn't see what your thought process was, maybe I, in some cases, wouldn't be able to figure out what you did, or wouldn't be able to figure out that you really knew which equation to use. So I want you to include the equation you're going to use in symbolic form so I know you've got the right equation, and then substitute the numbers in so that I can see that you do that process correctly as well. That is, in my mind, a bigger error not to put those calculations in. So I forget if it was 2 or 3 points, but it was one of the larger number of point penalties for the report, because most of you did things mostly correctly. Remember, though, that we're not supposed to use any form of first person or second person, so no I, we, me, our, my, us, you, y'all, youans, yous guys, none of that. All it. Let me think if there's anything else I left out. Purpose, data, calculations. No, I think that was it. Does anybody have any questions about the report that's due Friday? Presumably you have all started. You're all going to pretend that you started, right? Okay. Because we had some questions in the morning section. I don't remember exactly what was asked other than the general sense of it, which was, what the heck are we supposed to put in the lab report? Right? Meaning, like, what specifically did we have to put in there? Why was there solution A? Why was there solution B? So recall that we made a solid. That solid we're calculating a percent yield for. We took that solid and we divided up into 2 beakers. 1 beaker was pure water, where we were seeing how much of the solid maximum could dissolve. Since there wasn't anything in that solution to begin with, as much of that solid that can dissolve will dissolve. So it was like our control case, if you wanted to use that kind of terminology. Because there was nothing else in solution, then the iodate that formed had a stoichiometric relationship to the calcium that was formed. So the iodate and the calcium, we could make a relationship between the two. We're able to measure the iodate That's what we did through titration. So we get that iodate concentration to calculate KSP. We only calculate KSP for beaker A because it's not going to change when we move to beaker B, because equilibrium constants don't change with concentration. They can only change with temperature. The calculation would be more complicated for solution B because calcium potentially is coming from two sources: the calcium nitrate that you started out with in that solution, and then the calcium that would dissociate from that solid. So we didn't bother with the KSP for solution B. All we really wanted to see is that the iodate concentration that would form is less than the iodate concentration in the pure water. Why? Because, as I have said in reviewing the test question, if we calculate the concentrations of ions present and that exceeds your KSP value, that's when a precipitate's going to form. So in other words, you can only build those ions up to a certain level. If you already have calcium in solution, because we started with a calcium nitrate solution, then that's going to get us to where we approach that maximum KSP value much more quickly as we start to generate iodate. Because calcium produced is not directly related to iodate, it's a much bigger number to start with. So that's the common ion effect, that will diminish how much iodate goes into solution compared to pure water, and that's the observation we want to see. Lower iodate concentration in beaker B compared to beaker A. So let me say the much shorter version of that. The data or the calculations you need to do are the percent yield for the solid that's formed, the calculations for standardizing the thiosulfate, because that's what you use to do the test, calculation of the KSP for beaker A, because that's where you measure the, if you want to call it that, the pure iodate concentration. And then the last thing you need to show is that the iodate concentration is lower in beaker B, because that's the common ion effect. So as far as wording your purpose statement, you could say that the purpose of the experiment was to observe the common ion effect in calcium iodate. And then the conclusion would just be that the common ion effect was observed by the lower concentration of iodate found in beaker B versus beaker A. So after all that, does anyone have any questions on that lab report? Yes? Oh, you don't have to put that in your lab report. Yeah, the question was, what about all the different chemical reactions? Because we talked about how you take iodate and react it with iodide to make iodine, and the iodine reacts with thiosulfate. You don't have to write the chemical equations out, just the mathematical equations that you use in your calculations. Any other questions? Yes? You could if you wanted to. Depends on how you write your purpose statement. If you say that one of the purposes of the experiment is to determine KSP, then yes, in your conclusion statement, you should say what the KSP is. All right. Well, given what time we've got, let's quickly do an overview of the experiment that we're going to do today. And let me try to back up and give you an even larger context what it is we're going to be doing over the next several weeks. We are going to be getting what's known as qualitative analysis. Which is the identification of an unknown compound using qualitative tests, meaning ones that do not involve any kind of calculations, but just observations. So these qualitative tests They don't involve calculations. They involve observing if there's any evidence that a reaction has occurred. Which this is a bit like Chem 1A now, going back and talking about how do we know a reaction has occurred? What are some non-measurement signs that something has occurred chemically? Color change? I heard something else. Precipitate, that's right. What else? Gas formation. We'll talk about that one specifically in a moment. Burning, so combustion. Or, since we're dealing with just solutions, let's say temperature change. How about if there's a particular odor change? I mean, that is subjective, but that's the point of qualitative tests, that there are not the numbers involved. I forgot one that came up in a previous quarter. It's not often, but what if it happens to release light? There are photochemical reactions, so much less common of a thing that you would look for, but a possibility. We're going to talk more about some of these observations, particularly precipitation. A lot of the tests that we're going to do involve precipitation. But I just want to remind us of two gas-forming reactions. There are two that you've had, at least, if you've taken labs here at De Anza. I asked this morning what one of them was and was very surprised by the answer I got back. I got the one I didn't think people were going to guess. So out of curiosity, can you name a gas-forming reaction? That's exactly the one I was surprised that you all remembered, but that is entirely correct. So do you remember what reaction that was?
I forget the solvent that we used, but it was we inverted the thing.
Yes. 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 It is magnesium and hydrochloric acid. It's this reaction. Magnesium, it's a good choice for exactly this experiment, which the experiment she was describing is what we call here the udiometer experiment. It is the experiment where we measure the ideal gas volume constant. Magnesium is a good choice for this experiment because it's rather non-toxic, although if you light it, it's extraordinarily bright. Anybody ever seen lit magnesium? Yeah. Cheap, relatively safe experiment to do in the lab, as long as you don't look directly at it, because then it'd be like staring at the sun. You just have a black spot. The magnesium will then completely react with hydrochloric acid. It's a redox reaction. In the process, magnesium loses electrons, which is why it ends up as part of a salt. And then the hydrogen gains the electrons, so it gets reduced to hydrogen gas, which is the gas that bubbled up. Hydrogen being a good choice for this experiment because it acts very much like an ideal gas. Point is that that is a gas-forming reaction, and you might potentially have something like that occur if you are having redox reactions occur with these various unknowns that you're going to be testing. What kinds of unknowns are you going to be testing? Mainly ones with different metal cations. So if you looked ahead at the syllabus at all, you saw today we're doing the anion side of things, but there's quite a number of cation experiments that are coming. So you're going to be given a set of different unknown compounds. There's actually two sets, because anion tests are separate from the cation tests. So today you'll be given unknown anions to test, And then starting from next time, you'll have cations. Before we get any further, though, what's one other very common gas-forming reaction? This is the one that surprised me, because I thought this was the more common example. Did any of you, as kids, ever do the little science experiment where you build a little sand volcano, and then you get vinegar with some red food coloring, and you put it in with baking soda, and you get the lava to come out? Some of you are like, yeah, and some of you are like, what are you talking about? So I guess we don't go out and play with sand anymore, since we've got all these devices we play with instead. It's a simple experiment involving baking soda, which is what? What's one of the principal components of baking soda? Bicarbonate. And when bicarbonate reacts with an acid, it makes carbonic acid, which decomposes. I think that came up in lecture or something, didn't it? Or maybe I'm just thinking of this morning lab lecture. If we have sodium bicarbonate, and let's say we take acetic acid, because that's the active component of vinegar in this little demonstration I just described. You would get sodium acetate, plus, in theory, you get carbonic acid. The problem is that carbonic acid spontaneously decomposes into water and carbon dioxide. If you happen to have a salt that was in the form of a carbonate or bicarbonate, the one test then for that anion would to see if bubbling occurs when you react it with acid, which is exactly one of the types of things that you are doing in today's experiment. So, let me give you the really quick version of what you're doing in this experiment. You have three different unknowns. You're each going to get a bottle that's got a different color label on it. One of each of the three colored labels. Those are the three unknown samples that you're going to test. You're going to have a series of known samples as well, all of which I believe are sodium salts. There's a table that's in your book that I'm going to print out for you. Because one person this morning very, very politely begged, please, could we use our own charts like this instead of having to recopy everything into our lab book? And I guess I was having a moment of being a softie. So I said, yes, if you could paste this or staple this or somehow put this in your lab book where it won't fall out, then it is more convenient to take this pre-formatted table to write in your results. So, in fact, I will print some of these out right as you all are getting going, so you could use this to record your results if you wanted to. On this is the list of anions on the left. So you have listed here, for example, bromide, carbonate, chloride, hydroxide. So you'll have sodium bromide, sodium carbonate, sodium chloride all over here. The one thing we don't have is hydroxide, and I'm not exactly sure why that was taken out of our bucket, but there must have been some difficulty they had with it in the past, so we're skipping over that one. So all the remaining ones you're going to test, plus, as I said, you have these three unknown solutions. Do read over the procedure before you start in case you didn't read the pre-lab, because there's one line in particular that they didn't catch this morning at first, which is under the techniques used. The very first one talks about how you are only going to use a small quantity of the solid salt, quoting here, the size of a grain of sand. So when I saw the beakers full of solid that people were trying to take out this morning, I realized they didn't take the time just to read it really quickly. And I know that I sent that message out saying you wouldn't be penalized for not completing your pre-lab, but you need to know what you're doing in the lab. So even though I'm going to give you the description, you need to read through this once just to see what are the quantities. Are there any gotchas that I didn't mention? So essentially what you're going to be doing is this. You have these spot plates that are part of that kit that you checked out at the beginning of the quarter that I handed out to each one of you. Spot plates are a convenient way of doing a discussion or an investigation of a reaction with using very small quantities. you have the list of the different solids you're going to use. And so maybe, for example, in one of these, you'll put the sodium bromide and then maybe follow it up with sodium carbonate, sodium chloride, whatever all the different test solids are. You're not going to be able to get all of the test solids onto one spot plate, but that's okay. You can wash it out and just keep on repeating. You have on that side column of the table all the different anions, and then you have three different sets of test reagents that you're going to use. And you use each of these test reagents separately, meaning you'll set your spot plate up with solids once, you dissolve those solids up, you'll take the first test reagent, which is silver nitrate, and add it to all of them. You want to see how silver nitrate happens to react with all those different ones. Just to tell you partly what's going on there, if you had, for example, sodium bromide or sodium chloride, bromides and chlorides almost always are soluble, except in the presence of what three ions? Silver, which is why we're using the silver nitrate. That mercury plus one dimer that I showed you. Silver, mercury, lead. That's right. Your procedure points out that thallium-1 supposedly is also insoluble with halides, but when will we ever use thallium? So that's just an example of the type of thing that you're looking for, that maybe you're going to see a precipitate. So first test reagent is silver nitrate. Second test reagent is iron 3 nitrate. Now, there are two different iron reagents. Partly what we're looking for with reaction of iron is a redox reaction. Partly what we're looking for is to see if there's any precipitation reactions. So in terms of what you're going to be observing, if you see any kind of color change, if you see a precipitate, if you happen to see a color change and a precipitate, or maybe it gets cloudy, whatever it is you see, make sure to write that down as part of your observations. Next time when we have more time, I'll go through what each of the reactions going on is so we can discuss how to interpret those observations. For now, I'm just trying to get us through the work part so we have time to discuss later. One thing that's going to happen with this reagent, if it's bromide, chloride, or iodide, you're supposed to do one additional test beyond just adding these drops and seeing if anything happens. For those three different ions, or for the unknowns, because you don't know if your unknowns have halogens in them or not. So for those samples, add hexane. How much is described in your procedure, how to mix it up, what to look for, that's all mentioned in your procedure. Hexane has this formula to it. If you don't know how to read that formula, the CH... Did I really just do that? The CH2 in the middle means one carbon with two hydrogens attached, but carbon normally has four connections total. So putting it in brackets like that means there's a CH2 connected to another CH2 connected to another CH2 connected to a fourth CH2. That still leaves connections at either end, and so we have these CH3 groups that cap it off. It's a linear compound, in other words, that contains six carbons. That's where the hex in the name comes from, hex meaning six. Ane is an ending trying to show that the compound has only carbon-carbon single bonds. That ane shows up in propane, butane, ethane, methane, for example. Those are all single-bonded compounds. As an example of others, there's... well, that's a bad name example. There's butene, E-N-E, instead of A-N-E, that has a double bond. There's ethine with a Y that's got a triple bond. So, yeah, it sounds like some of you have heard that before, that nomenclature. What's that? So, oh, so you remember some of that. Okay. Did you do that in 1A or something? Oh, okay. Okay. So hexane, what that is it's a non-polar solvent. So it's water incompatible. It'll float on top of the water. But one of the things that may happen between iron and these halides is there might be a redox reaction where you produce bromine in the form of Br2 or iodine in the form of I2. Those compounds, bromine and iodine, will dissolve in hexane, turn them a color, and so it's one way of helping visualize if something in the reaction occurred. This only happens with the halogens. That's why you only do that test with a few things. So that's for the iron 3 nitrate test. So the rest of the compounds, you just add the drops, mix it up, see if anything happens. For these ions and the unknowns, you do the hexane test also. There's one more reagent, which is iron 2 sulfate. Oh, just because I bet it's been a while. Ferric is the common name for iron 3. Ferrous is the common name for iron 2. I don't tend to make students memorize the common names. Ferric, ferrous, plumbus, plumbic, argentus, argentic, silver. But you should know these names just in case the reagent bottles happen to be written that way. So the ferrous sulfate, iron 2 sulfate, that often acts as a reducing agent. So again, we might be looking for redox reactions. We might be looking for precipitation reactions. There's one more thing to do with that reagent, that if you don't get a reaction at first, then you add concentrated sulfuric acid. The highest concentration that we had earlier over there was 6 molar, which will work well enough for this test. I already alluded to the fact that if you happen to have carbonate, for example, which is an anion, if you add acid, you should see some kind of bubbling due to gas formation. So that was one of the things potentially we're looking for by adding that acid. So you have the set of compounds, you have these 3 set of reagents. There's a little side twist to 2 of the sets of reagents that I've described. Unlike what the procedure says, we're going to dispose of all of the waste just into 1 waste bucket. It is located at H5 today because we're starting to get full in the other fume hoods. Also, because we have sulfuric acid as something we may use, we need to segregate it out as acidic waste, which is why it's located with other acidic waste in H5. In terms of hazards, most of the anions are not terribly hazardous in the sodium form. Doesn't mean to go eat them. It just means that if you get a little bit on you, if you wash it off, take normal precautions, you'll be fine. I already warned you about the silver nitrate solution. Had someone from the morning section hold their hand up and say, yeah, I got some on me in this. They had a nice brown stain that they will get to walk around with for a few weeks as it tends to grow out. One of them did ask, is sulfuric acid concentrated nasty? And the answer is yes. Maybe 6 molar wouldn't instantly be harmful, but if you did have concentrated acid, and suppose you didn't wipe it off, well, it's permanently disfiguring. It can leave a scar that won't go away. So I know that we're not going to be using it like that, but that's why, even though these are such common chemicals and we may kind of ignore them, don't. Concentrated sulfuric, even if it's not 18 or 12 molar, even 6 molar can be nasty stuff over time. It's only half diluted from the really concentrated stuff. So do treat it carefully. The other reagents, the iron 2 and iron 3 reagent, again, not particularly hazardous, but you'd want to wash it off kind of quickly. Question back there. And that's what I'm saying. We're going to ignore that portion of it. Yeah. So if you if you do read the procedure, it does say that there's a potential hazard with the disposal of silver salts. But given the quantities that we have, we're just going to dispose all of it in together. Now, this is going to be done individually, not in pairs. For the unknowns, what I'd like you to do, even if you don't get to using them today, I'd like you all to come choose your unknowns, physically take them out of the bucket here, so that we all get different samples, because it makes it a little bit more interesting if you don't already know what it is that you're going to get in terms of your results. Now, the unknowns, please, please try to use good chemical handling techniques. I even see sometimes in the organic class just phenomenally horrible fundamental measuring techniques. Things like taking your dirty spatulas and pipettes and putting them into original bottles. Whenever you stick something into the container that's got that unknown, please make sure you've rigorously cleaned whatever spatula or pipette or whatever that you're going to use so that you don't contaminate those samples, because we are just doing qualitative tests, and if you happen to contaminate it, maybe it'll give false results for some of these tests. And they are samples that are going to be used in different sections. If you don't use the unknown today, return it. Don't save any of it, because we will have it here available the next time that we're in lab. I'm just wanting to make sure that we distribute them so we get a variety of samples out there, that we get total randomization of who's got which unknown. Let me just think one more time through the lab, see if there's anything important that I left out, because I talked about disposal, talked about safety. And I mentioned that the hydroxide is not available, so don't worry about that as one of the tests. Last time, last plea I'll make, if you did not do your pre-lab, read the procedure now. We do have Monday where we would be able to continue the experiment. So if it takes you time to read and you don't get much done today, at least you got a little bit more clue what you are doing once you get around to the experiment. If you do get done today, you still have to show up Monday, because we're likely to continue on with the cation experiment. Because I've been told that it's later on in this procedure where we have the potential to really bog down in terms of time. So I want to get ahead at the beginning while we can, in case that ends up happening to us. Any questions then? So read over your procedure. I've got one extra copy of the manual if you don't have it with you to be able to read. I will be printing out those data sheets for you just momentarily for you to be able to use to fill out if you'd like. And I'll go ahead and place the unknowns up here if you'll go ahead and pick those. One last time, don't save any of it in your own locker, because these same samples will be available. When you get the unknowns, write your unknowns down. You won't be graded necessarily for getting the right or wrong answers on these various tests, but you'll be marked off big time if you don't have your sample numbers, where I can't even tell if you got the right guess or not. So write down each sample number that you take. You're taking one of each colored label here, and so make sure you write down the color of the label along with it. So you have pink, blue, and yellow. So you'll be, for example, you'll have pink 29, yellow 10, and blue 11, or something like that.